What do you want from this guy? Canada Land, what do you want from him? Jagmeet Singh, what do you want from him? How do you expect him to act? Pierre Poilievre, what do you want from this guy?
Yeah, I guess transparency.
And really, there's only two directions that that goes. I guess we want him either to say, I don't have any stock options in Brookfield, which he has not said to us or anyone. Or we want him to say, I'll level with you. I have these stock options. Technically, there is a conceivable situation whereby my job as prime minister might come into conflict with my interests as an investor in Brookfield. But I'm asking you to trust me. I'm not going to do that. It's not enough money for me to do that. I didn't leave the private sector to enrich myself. And I think you should vote for me anyhow.
It's a pretty complicated idea, and just for us to understand it took weeks, and just to explain it in a podcast, it took, what, 30 minutes or something, whatever we're at now?
In an election campaign where axe the tax and slogans like that get thrown around, like, I could totally understand from the Carney campaign's point of view, you're riding high in the polls, and you're having this internal conversation of, do we go to the voter and say, hey, everybody, I haven't disclosed this before, but just so you know, I've got, you know, $4, 5, 6 million, which to me is like kind of nothing. Like, you don't want
a good look.
And by the way, let me explain what a stock option is.
Yeah, let me explain to the entire country, age 18 and above, how stock options work.
I totally get why they haven't done that. But that's not the team we play on. We play on team representing the public's right to know. And, you know, from our point of view here, should the public have the benefit of this information? Well, the conflict of interest law seems to think they should, you know, and it's only by a technicality that they don't. And we really don't know this guy yet. I keep saying this, but the Prime Minister of Canada is someone who we don't know much about yet. If he has millions bound up in foreign energy companies and in companies that Loblaws used to own, like, I think at a minimum, we should know about that before we head to the polls. Julian, before we go, I just want to, like, I don't know, digress for a second here.
Sure. Be my guest.
I feel like this whole area of conflict of interest is really poorly understood. It's become this thing where it feels like just the thing itself is accusatory. Like, he's got a conflict of interest. Like, you've done something wrong. There's nothing necessarily wrong with having a conflict of interest. Can I be, like, super pedantic for a minute?
Do it. Do it.
Let's imagine for a second the coach of a high school soccer team.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If his niece tries out for that team, he has a conflict of interest. He has an interest as coach in the team, you know, having the best players on the team and starting the best players and winning the most games. But let's assume he's a good guy. He also has an interest in his niece succeeding in her pursuits in life and having high self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
He's done nothing wrong, but he has a conflict of interest.
Yes.
The problem only comes if he doesn't tell everybody. Like, the right thing to do is you tell the players in case they don't know. Amy's trying out for the team. She happens to be my niece. Make sure the parents know. And then everybody can just kind of like have a conversation about it and say, all right, so what? You know, we're comfortable. We trust you, coach. We feel like when it comes down to it, you'll put the team's interests ahead of Amy's. And furthermore, we're really glad you told us because, you know, we can watch for that now. If you start doing weird stuff, like playing her every game and losing every game and giving her MVP, we can call you on that. And if we have to, we can get a new coach. And in turn, he can say, well, I'm glad I told you too, because not all decisions happen on a conscious level. And if ever I was tempted to tilt things in favor of Amy a little bit, well, I know I'm being watched. This is going to keep me honest. Right?
Yeah.
Nobody's done anything wrong in that scenario.
Yeah, but imagine if he didn't disclose this. Imagine if this girl's playing for the team. She's starting every game. She's getting MVP. She's getting free Tim Hortons before the game every time.
And she sucks.
And she sucks. no disrespect to this young lady.
Sorry, Amy.
Yeah. Imagine if it's only then that everybody finds out that this person is the coach's niece.
Yeah. I mean, that's not good for anybody. Like, now it's a sleazy thing. Why didn't Amy tell everybody? Why didn't the coach tell anybody? Like, now they've done something wrong.
Yes. Imagine if the parents get together and politely, you know, inform the coach. And imagine if one of these parents, let's say her name is Rosemary, starts to confront the coach politely and says, hey, we know that that's your niece. And he said,
look inside yourself, Rosemary. You start from a prior of conflict and ill will.
Julian, you really helped me understand this. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That is your Canada Land episode today. You can email me about it at jesse@canadaland.com. I read all of your emails. Tune in tomorrow. We sent our politics team to the True North Strong and Free Conservative Conference to document conservatives in their own habitat. That is going to be interesting. Check it out tomorrow. Today's show was reported and presented by Julian Abraham. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Today's episode was fact-checked by Max Collins, who is also our director of audio. I am the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Canada Land, funded by you.
I'm Sam Graywall, and today we're talking about the news. But mostly, we'll talk about who's controlling the agenda this federal election cycle, and what happens, as Orwell warned us, when external wars, trade wars, tariff wars, real wars become an all-consuming distraction. What happens when we lose control of the agenda?
Our last day with the Conservative campaign, and we have faced some very tough message control from the party.
Wait for that. Author and professor Laurie Turnbull, who has taught political science and public administration at Dalhousie, Queen's, Carleton, and Acadia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Laurie, I'm going to start with a quote. A population focused on bombs and external enemies has no time to think about internal change. The type of internal change, nation-defining change, what it means to be a Canadian and how we're going to protect our identity, even strengthen it as the global order is being rapidly redefined, is what's not being talked about this election. What happened to election-defining debates on the issues that shape who we are, what it really means to be Canadian? We'll get to that later, but first, I'm going to read a quote from the Toronto Star last month. About a half dozen outlets received this exact same email that I'm about to quote from. It was sent to them by Jenny Byrne, Pierre Poilievre's main campaign handler and the woman running the show at Conservative headquarters. Byrne wanted to calm the media down after it was announced that journalists would not be allowed to accompany the Conservative leader on his campaign plane, a sharp break from decades of election tradition. We would like to assure you that this campaign will be one of the most accessible and transparent campaigns in recent memory. We have taken multiple steps to ensure the Canadian media will be able to share any public events, participate in those events on the ground, and ask their questions remotely and in person. Whew! That was a relief. Thank you for clearing that up, Jenny Byrne. And then, after the CBC laid out this pretty worrisome anecdote and going through what happened with a reporter in terms of cherry picking.
Our last day with the Conservative campaign, and we have faced some very tough message control from the party, not only breaking with tradition in the sense that we are not allowed to accompany the campaign, but also we've seen great control over the questions. We have not been allowed to ask any questions during the week that we've been with the Conservatives. Today we made an effort to get a question, and they told us that we could ask one, but that it had to be my colleague Tom Parry who asked the question. We responded that I was the one who had the question, and we preferred that I asked it. At that point, they took our question away and gave it to another outlet. We've also seen efforts to find out what reporters are going to ask, to pressure them to reveal what their question will be before the news conference. And of course, those that's asked before the party decides who gets to ask a question. And we've also seen some fairly heavy-handed treatment by Conservative Party staffers, including some pushing and shoving, as we saw on the public wharf at Petty Harbour in Newfoundland. So it's been a difficult week. It's difficult to get the same level of accountability from the Polyev campaign as it has been from past Conservative campaigns, or from the other parties in this election campaign.
The Globe and Mail, Simon Hoped, on April 5th, he writes a piece describing what happened to a Globe and Mail reporter. I'll read from it. In one case, when the Conservative leader was visiting British Columbia, a staffer suggested to a Globe and Mail reporter that they should ask a question about a new study on the effects of drug decriminalization. Basically, what happened was Polyev and the Conservatives trying to spin, you know, narratives around crime, tough on crime. They try to plant a question so they can basically dictate the agenda around the issue that Polyev wants to talk about. And basically the Globe said, you know, stuff yourself, and we're ignored. And apparently, I don't want to get the details wrong on this, but it's possible that they were able to get that question planted with another reporter. And, you know, I just thought, oh my, like, I honestly, you know, I've been doing this for almost 35 years. I'm not sure in Canada I have ever heard of an outlet, much less like the national newspaper, being told, hey, we want to give you the question that we want asked. Lori, that's some dark stuff. This is Orwellian Big Brother stuff, trying to spin this crazy, you know, scary crime agenda. What is going on?
Yeah, there are a few things. One thing I would say is that the Conservatives are trying to run a kind of parallel universe campaign where the polls are all showing that Carney is doing extremely well. Some polls have them tied. Some polls have the Liberals in the lead. When you look at leadership, like who people have faith in as the next prime minister, or who people can see as handling Trump the best, the economy the best, all those big questions, Carney's ahead of Polyev by a mile. And so the Conservatives are trying to pretend that's not happening. And they're trying to get the media to be complicit in this parallel universe that they're trying to create. So don't come with us on the plane, because you're going to be able to see how the sausage is being made. You're going to be able to see the look in people's eyes. Are people stressed out about this? What are people concerned about? Is the leader in a good mood? What's going on? Is Jenny mad? Nope, we don't want the media to know anything about that. So you guys stay out there. When we show up to a rally where we're going to have 6,000 or more people, 15,000 people in some cases, yelling and screaming, and Pierre Polyev is the best thing since sliced bread, and every time he says axe the tax, they all start cheering.
I will axe the tax for everyone, for everything, for real, for good, forever.
And stop the crime. Oh, yep, they love that too.
And so we are going to stop the crime. We're going to stop the crime.
And so they want the media to participate in this narrative building that these are the issues that are important. And as everybody knows by now, right, like Corey Tenight was the one who went and gave the speech to the Empire Club in Toronto, one of the most senior conservative strategists in the country, and says if Polyev doesn't stop it, the party's not going to win the election, because he has to start talking about what people are thinking about.
And if they don't get on it and get on it quick, they are going to get obliterated.
But Polyev is saying, nope, I'm going to talk about what I want, and I'm going to give you the impression that that's what people care about. And people do care about crime. There's no question they do. Just because we're now concerned about Trump and the tariffs and the economy doesn't mean we don't care about that other stuff. It means that I think there's a move toward a ballot question that's more about economic uncertainty. And Carney will score very highly if that's the ballot question. And so Polyev is trying to run this kind of parallel campaign and hope that by the end of the campaign, Canadians are less worried about the economy, and then kind of swerve back to those issues that he's always been talking about that had been resonating with people.
Let's go a little bit deeper with this, though. I cannot believe that a campaign that one of the major political parties would go to the national newspaper, to a reporter, and say, hey, we are going to tell you what we want you to do. We are going to tell you how you're going to do it. And if you don't play by our rules to allow us to set the agenda, to allow us to have this one-way communication channel with the public, we are going to cut you out of our engagement altogether. We're not going to call on you at all. And again, I don't want to be like poli-sci 101, George Orwell, 1984, authoritarianism and totalitarianism, and how does it come about? But is there any truth to a concern that this is a pretty big step toward that kind of a relationship where Big Brother becomes the media?
I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that there is a major, major problem if a politician feels that they can hand the script to the media and say, ask us this or else we're not going to play ball with you. That is a sure sign that there is no respect for what the media are there to do.
I need to make this point. Sorry, I just used the media like 10 times, you know, when I asked you that question. And so I'm criticizing myself. We need to stop using the term the media in this context all the time. What we should start saying is there's no concern for the public. We don't give a damn about voters. We don't give a damn about constituents, right? The media is just the voice of the public. They're asking those questions for the public. They want to know this information for the voter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's exactly it. They're performing that function because the voter, the public needs that information. And so I think where it all lands is that the people involved, the political party or the politician or the political operator or whoever it is who's saying to the media, these are our terms, we'll tell you what to say, and if you don't do it, we're not going to play ball with you. They're in this to win. That's the point. If we're looking at this as this is an election that's based on the public interest and voters get to be informed and go make a decision about who's the right person to run the country, that is the mythology of democracy. And it's not what we really see in real life. We see the media being disrespected, and I agree. The media as a proxy for the public, as a representative of the public, we see the public be disrespected all the time. And it doesn't always take the same form. Even in Nova Scotia, the premier has gotten in a little bit of hot water. Not too much. He's still up by 30 points in the polls. But he's had a little bit of a bumpy ride since he's won a second election for not wanting to take the media's questions, not putting any priority on this.
Caught our attention when we heard that Nova Scotia's premier appears to be taking a page out of the Trump playbook.
Tim Houston has moved media availability to this room across the street, which means no more media scrums and interviews in the legislature.
And again, you're right. Like, it's a proxy for the public. You're saying the public's not going to get this information. The public doesn't have access to the premier. And it's like they just assume they'll get away with it. They're preying on an apathetic public. They are preying on a public that might have enough trust to think, you know what, we're not the U.S. We're in good shape. Our democracy's okay. No, it's not. It's super not okay. No, and we're seeing that all the time.
After the break, we'll talk about what it would look like to push back against the bullying of the press and how journalists can take the agenda back. And we'll talk about Doug Ford. I'm glad you took it to our democracy. The example I want to use is Doug Ford right here in Ontario. He has been very effective in setting the agenda the last few elections. You know, I could not believe this past election in Ontario, as an example of what you said about democratizing fundamental sort of principles of our identity here in Canada and what the public, at their core, what they think about healthcare, education in the provincial context, affordability, the housing issue that we talked about. Hardly any of this was dealt with in the election. We voted for Ford, and, you know, maybe there were some other problems with his opponents, and maybe there were other strengths of his. But primarily, we basically said, oh, my God, like, Donald Trump's the enemy. America's the enemy. And Ford's going to be the panacea. He's going to be the Captain Canada. He's going to get us through this. And we didn't ask any of those questions.
The reason given for the snap election a year and a half before one was scheduled is all about receiving a clear mandate to take on Donald Trump and the looming tariff war knocking on Canada's door.
But the question I want to ask you is, let's say Poilievre does win and he does become prime minister, and he's controlled the agenda. And those who voted for him start to wonder 6 months from now, 2 months from now, a year from now, hold on, we didn't sign up for a lot of what he ends up doing. And that's the problem with giving him the microphone, handing the agenda over to him, because then we really lose sight of what might he do? What might he fail on spectacularly? Just like a Doug Ford, right? The environment, for example. What's at stake when the agenda is taken away from the public?
Oh, so many things to say. I'll start here. Doug Ford decided to go for a third term. He is going to run against Donald Trump and the threats that Donald Trump is hovering over Canada and Ontario. And Doug Ford is going to have everybody stressed out so much that he's going to get a pass on the state of the healthcare system, the state of the education system, the things that people actually really do care about a lot. And if the election were fought on those things, Doug Ford might have been a bit more worried. But he says, nope, I'm going to change this. I'm going to go to election now, 16 months early, when I've got this big, ominous threat of economic ruin, and hoist myself up as the person who's the best to deal with that. And meanwhile, the opposition parties are like, hello, here's all the things that are wrong with healthcare, education, things that are the prime focus are supposed to be of provincial governments. Here's Doug Ford's record on those things. Ontario, what do you think about this? And they couldn't get through. Half of the people in Ontario don't vote. So there's that. Doug Ford is absolutely banking on an apathetic public. And of the ones that are left, he's getting around 40% of the popular vote. The other 60%-ish is split between parties. And so even though he's got a third majority government and this big mandate, and he talks about being the premier for everybody, what is it, like 18% of people in Ontario actually voted for him? So what do we do as the voters? Well, the more of us vote, the better, because a lot of this is because politicians can absolutely assume that the race that they're running to win and this separation out of democracy being for the public interest and instead being a political game, that's totally easier to do when most people in the public aren't voting. So that's one thing. We can show up. We can vote. We can get informed. There's no reason we can't put pressure on the media. Let's talk about what we need as a public, or else we're not going to be able to participate in democracy as we want to. The other thing, our institutions don't work so well. Like, they really don't. We really need to be thinking about this stuff. When I say 50% of people aren't voting, then the vote is split among parties, and now Doug Ford has a huge mandate for 4 more years, and most people would not vote for Doug Ford and did not vote for Doug Ford. That's an institutional issue, and we need to take some hard looks at that stuff.
My kid's in school and the education system's crumbling. I've got an aging parent and I don't really know if the healthcare system is going to do much for them. They're going to maybe go into senior care someday and I don't even know how that sector is operating. Whatever it might be that motivates you to vote, whatever your priority is, what bothers me, what worries me is when we lose the ability to get to vote for the person that's going to fulfill those things that I want. Because we never found out what any of these parties are actually going to do for me. And taking it back to the media, like, why did Polyev think he could just boot all of the journalists off his plane? Why did his handlers in the party think we can bully journalists at a presser? Is there a responsibility to sort of take on a tougher stance, a slightly more aggressive stance, the kind of journalism that, frankly, I grew up in?
I certainly see that argument. I wonder what the effect social media is having, because I think part of the reason why Polyev and the conservatives are saying, look, ask these questions or we don't want you here, is because they don't need the media to follow their campaigns anymore. They can write their own material. They can record it themselves. They can put it out there. They can kind of run their own communications channels without relying on media to carry their messages. And I think these days when there are so many, I mean, people have overused the phrase echo chambers, but there's less engagement with traditional media. There's less engagement in the sense that everybody's not reading the same papers and watching the same news every night. People are engaging in whatever kind of media seems to honestly reinforce their own interests, their own priorities, their own viewpoints. And so I think there's an argument to be made that traditional media, reporters following a political campaign for a general election, you don't have the same leverage as you did before because the party doesn't need you. That said, do you have to take this crap from the person who says, ask me this question or you're not coming in? No, you could leave. and write a story about how miserable that experience was, but are voters going to care? Not necessarily, because we only get one vote every once in a while, and voters might want to cast their ballot on the basis of healthcare, education, economy, jobs, immigration, housing, any of those things. Like, we have accountability deficits in our system. People do get away with behaving badly. Where is the accountability for the conservatives telling the media that they're not going to play ball with them? It's hard. Like, it, you know, other than the media really standing up and saying, look, we won't follow you then. We're not going to come to your rallies. We're not going to participate in your manufacturing a narrative that Pierre Poilievre is some social media rock star because we're not going to be used like this. And then are you going to be accused of, okay, so now the media aren't following us. They hate us. They hate the conservatives. So it's like, oh, there is no truth anymore. There's just opinion. It's really annoying.
Yeah. An example I'll give about good media sort of response in a very, in my opinion, objective way, just in the name of journalism, was when the Toronto Star, it went through a very difficult time when Rob Ford was the mayor of Toronto. Basically, the Ford administration turned the Star into the enemy.
Toronto Mayor Rob Ford and his brother, Councillor Doug Ford, say local media organizations are out to get them. That the Toronto Star, among others, are practicing gutter journalism.
Very aggressive.
Yeah.
You know, trying to intimidate reporters. At one point, they basically said they were not going to respond to any Toronto Star questions, any Toronto Star journalists. And that happened for a while. Like, I can't remember how long it was, but it was something like a year that Ford just simply tried to cut the Star out. And luckily, there was a really, really strong, principled leader at the Star at the time. His name was Michael Cook. He was the head honcho. I thought he was just so vital to the Star. He had come in, he had a really kind of tough British tabloid background. He headed up a whole bunch of big newspapers in the States. He had a little bit of that tabloid mentality, but he also had a deep investigative bent and a real, almost profound public service orientation. And what he basically did at the Star was he said, no, we're going to stand up to these folks because the public needs it. You know, I had a politician. I was really hard on her. In my opinion, she was a terrible politician. A lot of my reporting was, you know, credited with bringing her down. I was at an election event, and one of her supporters walked up to me, threw coffee right in my face. It was well reported.
Oh, my God.
And I'm not saying put yourself in situations where your safety is going to be in jeopardy. I'm not advocating for that. But I'm just wondering, what would it look like to take the agenda back? Lori, we like to duly note stories on this show so they don't get overlooked. Do you have something you'd like to duly note?
Well, one thing I would duly note as part of this whole election campaign, who's going to cross the finish line first kind of thing, is this is the first election that we are going to have under the new electoral boundaries. So we look at the boundaries every 10 years after the census is taken to see where the population has shifted and whether seats need to be added, whether boundaries need to be redrawn in order to make sure that there's roughly the same number of people in every riding. And so we've had pretty significant redrawings with this new set of boundaries that came into effect. And so we will see what sort of effect this has. But a lot of MPs who are returning are looking at pretty different voter bases inside their constituencies. And they're going to have to lift off a different thing in order to be able to connect with new voters. Some people have argued that overall, this is going to help the conservatives, the way the boundaries are drawn. But let me stress, we do that independently. It's not gerrymandering. It's just overall, the effect looks like that might be the case. But for all of the talking we do about popular vote, and for all of the gazing at polls and comparing the different poll results, and what matters is who comes first in every riding. And we do not know that yet.
Duly noted. That's our show for today. Thanks for joining us, Lori. You can email me about it at san.grewal@thepointer.com. That's san.grewal@thepointer.com. I read everything you send. Lori, where can people find you?
Thank you so much for having me. And I'm on X somewhere. I'm on the Dalhousie website. That's probably the easiest thing.
This episode is produced by James Nicholson, mixing and mastering by Caleb Thompson. Our director of audio is Max Collins, fact-checked by Sam Connert. Jesse Brown is the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Theme music is by So Called. Syndication is by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.